Caught between rocks, the blue mud ushers in glacial till. Our feet are so old, root hairs in sand, the pace of plants. God, we are plodding, sucking, and mouthing. Leaves carve up air, times do change. A new appendage, soaking gauze, wire through the tongue. Who can say love or drought or name the place we women are straddled, sodden, at home in so many bodies of water?
I wonder if you can talk to us first about your style, which I guess is called what, experimental, modern, contemporary, abstract?
Maybe all of the above. I like to think of it as physical, actually, and it might not sound that way, but I really think of language as coming out of the body into the world and connected to air, connected to breathing, everything that makes us human. So it doesn't matter so much to me if things make sense in a usual way, but that you hear sounds, you feel like you're in the midst of language. So some of my poems are just words kind of piled together. And as you read through them, to me, it's like looking at a forest floor, and there's all this density, all this vegetation. It's sort of separate. You can isolate separate things, but you can't say it all. It's just all there together. So that kind of confusion, that sounds like confusion sometimes, to me is a way of immersing your mind, your body in the language, in the same way you immerse yourself in the natural world when you take a walk and you feel the sun and you think, wow, it's touching my skin everywhere. You know, there's that sense of surrounding.
That's helpful. I love poetry, but I struggle a little bit with experimental poetry. But I'm starting to grasp the idea when I think of it as an abstract painting in a way. And I think, well, when I go into a museum, I enjoy the realism, but I also enjoy sometimes just colors mixing together, shapes and the composition. And when I think of poetry that way, and your description is yet another way of thinking of it, that forest floor, I love that.
You know, it's exactly like abstract painting in the sense that we think of paint as a physical material, but language, sometimes we don't think of it as a physical material, and I really do. And it's funny what a difference that makes then. The idea of like a linear thought, we start at the beginning, we make sense, we come to an end. That makes sense for language that you kind of see through. You're not really thinking about the sounds or the pace or emotions even. And I think in the way we listen to music, we feel very close to it, but it's not saying anything directly. When language works that way, it's not that it has to be incomprehensible, but it has to be experienced. For me, I like it to be experienced as a kind of physical experience. So I like to listen, like to just hear how it goes, write it out.
That's fascinating. And you don't write just poetry. You also write fiction. You write nonfiction. Do you have something of that same approach with prose as you do with poetry, or you're a different writer then?
And not completely different. I think the stories especially are very close to prose poems sometimes. And I don't always make a distinction. Something that I write thinking of as a poem may end up as a short story. I always struggle with discursive, logical, argumentative prose. It's just not, it doesn't feel comfortable to me. It's like, I have written, you know, I can write things like that, but it feels almost as if you're using language then as this instrument, an artificial matter, and it doesn't feel natural to me. Because of my concern for the natural world and paying attention to where we live sort of as our home within nature, I think I'm very determined to have language part of that, sort of part of what I think of as the natural world, part of our bodies within that.
You know, I've been thinking about that recently, too, when I've been writing some prose, and I think about, especially with novels, we have gotten into this beginning, middle, end format, very chronological. We allow some flashbacks now and then. But to me, I've been thinking, I want it to be comprehensible, and yet at the same time, it's not how we think. It's not how we experience life. It's not how we revisit our memories. And if you really sit back, listen to somebody's conversation, it goes off on tangents all the time. So it's that trying to find that reality and still be able to follow it.
Absolutely. It would be odd if we really talked or thought the way we write.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an artificial construct that has certain limits and definitions about how you proceed. And we certainly need those for writing and making instructions clear. I mean, the very language that makes sense is very useful.
Yeah.
But the other thing that played into this particular book of poems and the eco-dementia part, the dementia in some ways also connects to literal dementia that my father experienced. And so talking to him in the last stages of Alzheimer's was so interesting. He was hallucinating, of course, sometimes, so he would be saying strange things. But the way the things went together made a
different sense. He probably talked like we think.
Yeah, it was like almost a dream experience.
Yeah.
And so I thought in thinking about the natural world, we are kind of insane in the ways we damage it. And we can have done this for centuries now. And it seems to me it's like a disease. I kept thinking how similar my response was when I see some kind of destruction or landscape, you know, leveling that goes on.
Yeah.
I was feeling as bad about the landscape as I was about my father. There was that sense of loss, tremendous destruction. The other thing he kept saying, and everybody who has dementia seems to say, you know, I want to go home, take me home. And he'd be packing to go home all the time.
That's true.
And so I think about what is our home.
Yeah.
And the natural world, to me, we forget that our home isn't just the house and the family. And, you know, it's a wider thing that supports us and sustains us. And so I think in some ways we have all lost that profound sense of home that we protect and care for. And so I really identified with my father a lot because he was struggling to find home, which didn't exist for him anymore. He wasn't even sure what it was.
Yeah. And you take on some other pretty heavy topics in the book, Hurricane Katrina, the toxins in Lake Erie. So talk about a little bit more about the eco part of it. You've started to a little bit here.
Well, in some ways for me, that's really what guided my thinking through this whole collection. With climate change and with all the other kinds of damage that we've done to habitats for animals, I mean, it just seems that we have almost gone crazy. We don't see it as insanity because it's what we do as human beings. We take over
land. Is it that
land.
We don't think about the longer consequences, the long term?
Absolutely. Or? And we don't think about other living creatures as having sort of the same rights to survival in a habitat as we do. And we don't think of our own world as the habitat. So I think it's going to be a struggle as long as human beings are around to try to figure out how we can both love the world, and we do. I mean, people love to go out into nature. They love to sit in the sun or go to the beach or whatever. But sometimes it doesn't connect to actual economic or political thought about how you sustain that around you. So I think there's a way that we're in the midst of a really, really important struggle to change the way human beings see themselves in the world. And it's nothing new. There have always been people who identified fully with the whole of nature and the whole of the planet. But I think it needs to infiltrate into every aspect of human life right now.
So are climate change deniers people with a certain type of Alzheimer's?
I think we're all people with a certain type of Alzheimer's.
To some degree,
because we can't live, it's hard to live in our society, especially, without doing damage. I mean, everything we buy is almost connected at some point in its life cycle
with
devastation. So we need all of us, not just where we are politically, but human beings need to really work to protect their home. All of us understand how to do that in personal terms. But in terms of the planet, it's harder because more needs to change. You can't just complain to your children and try to teach them something different.
Yeah.
With this, you have to change economic structures. You have to change just the ways people revere and love what's around them.
If you think of yourself living in a small room, would you throw garbage down on the floor? I mean, maybe you would, but, you know, I hope not. You live on a farm, yes?
I grew up on a farm, and I farmed hay for many years, but for about the last 20 years, I have not farmed. In fact, I've stopped farming, restored wetlands on the property.
I'm curious to hear more about restoring wetlands. What happened there, and how do you go through that process of restoring them?
Well, when I was farming hay, when you would hit the low spots in the field and bale the hay, it was always wet. So clearly there was damp moisture in the ground at those places. And as anybody in Michigan learns if they deal with land at all, in order to farm, you need to drain the surface because there were so many swampy areas. And that's done by burying drainage tiles. At first they were clay, now they're plastic. So the tiles in the ground get the soak up the water from rain or from anything and take it away so you can farm. Well, when I was stopping the hay, we just decided to work with a federal program, the Wetlands Reserve Program, and that was initiated years ago, where you could have people come in with a backhoe, dig up the tiles, and just crush the ones for maybe 50 feet or so, and then the water would return.
Does because that those work with the plastic tiles as well, or just the ceramic
that's
ones?
Easier in a way to just rip that out. I mean, before settlers drained that land, there were all these wetlands, all these holes full of water everywhere in forests and every place.
Well, Michigan is a really wet state.
That's right.
I think I heard somewhere that wherever you are in Michigan, you're never more than 30 miles from a lake.
And I think it's even closer. I think I've heard
three. I'm thinking that, too, as I hear
it's really
you.
Close.
Yeah.
And if you had all the original wetlands, I mean, they'd be...
You'd be in water all
over
the time.
The place. And it's really interesting the effort to restore wetlands, because it also helps with flooding. It holds water back from that rush that goes underground through the tiles, otherwise into streams.
Yeah.
So it's been great. And as the years have gone by, the seed bank in the soil has got sedges growing, all kinds of native plants that I never knew would still be in the soil or would regenerate. So it's become a natural area. And it's just a huge pleasure to see the diversity of things. So I think that whole process of doing that was a further sort of process of coming to understand how far, I mean, I was from understanding how full these spaces are.
Yeah.
You almost have to experience it. Otherwise, things just look like wasteland or scrub or brush, and people are always mowing them and cutting them down or whatever. Rather than understanding that these things are hugely important as well as beautiful. And so it's important to educate people, but also just have them experience it. I mean, I really
think it begins with that. Get out in nature. And, and then when you fall in love, then you're more inclined to try to do something to preserve it. So the love comes first.
That's the other part of the crazy in this, the dementia part, because I think there is a kind of crazy love we do have as human beings. How can you
An
not?
An abusive love?
True. And that's the insanity part of it. That's what's crazy.
We keep trying to control it and domineer over it. So, that is abusive.
Yeah. It's both sides of those things. We have to really somehow bring it together so we can survive peacefully. And
so you've probably seen lots of birds and insects and other kind of wildlife return?
Yeah, with some other people, friends and other scientists have come. I've had people come to document species because I know some birds, but I don't know a lot. So there are some birders who've been helping me document species there. The Michigan Natural Features Inventory is a group of scientists and aquatic people who came to document the freshwater mussels in the stream. They're very rare freshwater mussels all over the world, but that stream has, I think it was 9 or 13 species in it, including one that's really threatened in Michigan. Yeah. So these little streams, especially in ag land, where there's so much use of the land for agriculture, to keep those streams good, you need forested buffers, lots of space and cooling water. And it's wonderful to see how that can happen and how it can take place.
I moved out to an old farm about 6 years ago. 5 acres of the farm had been used as a cornfield. And I just let it go. And it's been so interesting over the years to watch it change over time. And every year it's different, you know, the type of plants, the type of animals living there. And that's been a fascinating process to me.
It's wonderful. It's great to have the opportunity to see that.
Also reassuring, nature is strong and resilient. I mean, that's, we can't take that for granted, though.
No, that's right. And I think it's the fundamental consolation human beings have. I mean, we all die. So there's some consolation in the understanding of the fullness of these life cycles.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very heartening thing.
So when you're writing, Janet, is it a instinctual thing that you feel or some other way? How do you know a great poem, whether yours or someone else's?
I have no idea how to answer that question.
So it is instinctual. You just know?
I don't know. I think of things more in a more ephemeral way, more as I didn't want to even use the word like example. They're like fragments. They're like found things that are suddenly just catch your eye. I mean, I love it when you're walking along and you see twigs arranged in a certain way. And I mean, maybe there's the letter Z or something, you know, you think there's a happenstance assemblage of things. And I find that just really a wonderful thing in nature. And I find that in language. So some poems strike me that, not just mine,
they're
but
just
other,
pleasing to you.
Yeah,
you
just
them.
Like the way those lines go together. They just, it's not that they fit, it's not that they're great, but they're just really interesting. You know, it's not that I ever even think about whether a poem's a great poem.
Yeah.
But, and I think that's why people can disagree about these things, because what catches your eye, what gives you some kind of real pleasure or sort of a thought
mm-hmm.
that you hadn't had before, that can come in all kinds of odd places.
Mm, interesting. Okay. What other projects are you working on right now?
Well, actually, this eco-dementia thing began as a broader project, including some photographs. The cover of the book is one of the photographs I took at the farm. It's of Indian grass. And then I manipulated my body to create shadows and explosions of light on it. It was
so
really
fun. So you're a photographer, too.
Well, not really, but it's an experiment like anything else. And
yeah.
I love to look at things very close up, and I love to alter them. So that's also part of what I think of as connected in my mind. They haven't come together in a space yet, but the photography and some mixed media kinds of work using found objects. Those are the sorts of things I do when I have.
I'm visualizing this whole art gallery thing with words, with poems, with photography, with art projects, with found projects.
I'd love to see that sometime.
Yeah.
If there's any way I would feel really pleased to see my work in a public space, that would be it. That kind of just mix of all these things that at least in my mind go together.
Anything I haven't asked you that you'd like to add about the book or?
No, the only thing I really think a lot about is the sense of lostness that many human beings feel. Just this sort of minor weird feeling in your stomach that things aren't right or depression or whatever. And I think there's a way that for me, rather than finding a psychological cause or a political cause or something, it's more that we are not at ease in the world, that we have lost
increasingly
our home,
so, yeah.
And we don't recognize it as that. I mean, when I was teaching, I used to ask students to think of their earliest memory when they really, you know, just were having a good time or something and were playing. And almost always they were playing in some scrappy place, like a ravine, a weedy ditch, you know, the edge of some water. And I think that sense of just being at play in a world where you enjoy yourself, you know what you're dealing with, and you can fool around. You don't have to be worried about where you are. As we get older, that we lose all that sense of real immediate play in the world. So that's the kind of thing I spend a lot of time thinking about and love to watch kids when they're outside and see why human beings aren't doing more of that sort of free moving of them, their bodies in the air.
You're de-stressing me just listening to you. Thank you so much for coming in, Janet.
It was good talking to you. Thank you.